Today on The Grave Talks, Demonic Takeover. Just another investigation, or so thought paranormal investigator Stacy Jones as she embarked on a journey through a cemetery with her team one night. This investigation should have been no different than the countless others she had been on, except for the fact that her nearly teenage son would be joining her out of convenience. This was a mistake that would lead to many months of torment and heartache, as an unseen entity would take the opportunity of this investigation to attach itself to her son and refuse to let go. What followed the investigation included unexplained noises in their house and a dramatic shift in the behavior of her son. Stacy eventually turned to friend and colleague John Zaffis to help her son move away from the dark entity that followed her family home. Was she successful in removing the demon? That's what we find out today on The Grave Talks.
I started investigating the paranormal back in 1984 was my first investigation. Basically, it came down to my librarian in my town. I grew up about 60 miles outside of New York City. The librarian in my town had said, you know, the people who live in that house across the street think it's haunted, and I actually just knocked on their door and did my first investigation then. I wanted to become a parapsychologist. I did look into going into Duke University and realized that it was an awful lot of education, awful lot of money for something I was never going to get a job in. So I decided in 1985 to become a police officer. So I joined the academy. I never really left the whole paranormal behind, but it was such a different time that it was not something that you ever talked about. I met my first husband in 1989 at an investigation in Central New York, and you know, just basically it was kind of a closet hobby. And in 1996 is when I had started my group in Central New York called Central New York Ghost Hunters. And started with basically five people in the group, and at its height, I had over 100 members, which was probably right around the time of you know, this incident. And I knew and remembered what it was like to have this interest and not being able to talk about it. And I wanted to create a group where anybody was welcome, you know, skeptics included, because I really believe that thinking outside the box is the healthiest way to do it. So in between the time of starting my first investigation and starting the group, I was a police officer and responded to a complaint of a single mom that had three boys that believed her ex-husband was harassing her. And we kept getting phone calls going back, and there was never any evidence that it was the ex-husband, but it kind of pointed to the fact that the house was haunted. So after the fourth time, my partner said to her, you know, don't call us again unless you physically see somebody. And that was kind of the day that I started my group, because I really felt she would not be as afraid as she was if she had a little education. So I went back to this woman's house about a week later. She had moved out in the middle of the night. And about 3 months after this, I kept an eye on the house, you know, to see if anybody else had moved in. And about 3 months after this, on my way to work, I discovered that the house was on fire and it burned to the ground within 15 minutes. So that was the day that I started really kind of branching out and talking about it more. You know, especially being a cop, that was something that I had to tread lightly, and during the time, because, you know, it was before the shows were ever on, and it was kind of, you know, there wasn't very many of us, you know, doing this as a group, but I expanded more and more. And in 1999 is when I left the police force, and my son Jamie, who was 8 at the time, started becoming severely ill, so I walked away from police work, and that's when I really opened up and really, really opened this up as a group. So fast forward to the year 2000, five, I got a phone call from a person in Central New York who had just started a group, and we decided that we were going to go do a ghost hunt. And we had been to this cemetery once before, and I had not gone over the evidence between the first visit and coming back to the second visit to the cemetery. So my son, Jamie, at the time, who was 14, was skating around town, and I told him to meet us back, and I didn't have time to bring him home before we went to this ghost hunt, so I decided foolishly to bring him with me. So we got to this cemetery, and it was members of my group, and it was members of another group, and we had done this ghost hunting in the cemetery. Jamie was with me, and the show portrays that, you know, we started seeing shadow people, which is the truth, we did, but we weren't afraid. You know, we kind of learned over the years that shadow people were nothing really to be afraid of, but the show really kind of put the blame that the shadow people really was the catalyst in this whole thing, but that's not really what happened. You know, we noticed it, you know, we kind of notated it, and we moved on.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in the cemetery, and we're doing our thing, and my son was given a pair of dowsing rods, and this was something that I'm very on the fence about. I really don't know if they work, and I thought this would be kind of a safe thing for Jamie to kind of play with, and we were given these dowsing rods, and I said to Jamie, I said, you know, I don't know if I really believe in these, but why don't you ask us to take us to a Smith tombstone? And the reason why I chose Smith was because it was such a common name that I figured there's got to be at least five or six in this cemetery.
Sure.
So we were walking around with these dowsing rods, and he's following the dowsing rods, and sure enough, it brings us to a Smith tombstone that was completely covered in dead grass and leaves and, you know, nothing that he could have seen beforehand. And I thought, well, you know, that's kind of interesting. So we're in the cemetery, and we're following the dowsing rods, and then I kind of realized that at this point that we were far away from everybody else. And I said to Jamie, I said, you know, we need to find our way back. So we were starting to walk back, and of course we're trying to follow our tracks, and I said to Jamie, I said, you know, I said, tell the dowsing rods to take us back to where the group is. So he did, and sure enough, it was a straight line with the dowsing rods right back to the group. And as we were walking back to where the rest of the group was, we started hearing footsteps behind us. And, you know, I kept looking over my shoulder thinking, you know, hey, there's a member behind us. You know, somebody was following us and nobody was there. And I started walking faster, and, you know, I'm not saying anything to Jamie at this point, and Jamie's keeping up with me, and the footsteps really just kept up with our pace. And just before we got to the group, the footsteps met up with us. That's the only way I could describe it. So, you know, we did our thing. We said our goodbyes to this other group, and, you know, we all got in our cars and we went home. So the next morning, I'm in the kitchen, and Jamie wakes up, and this is now August 1st, and I'm in the kitchen, and Jamie comes in and shows me a scratch on his leg, and it was the scratch of a star. And what really got me was how perfectly formed this star was, and it wasn't like, you know, a connect the dots type of thing. It was the outline of a star, and it seemed to be really, really just kind of perfect, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it, and Jamie showed it to me, and I kind of, you know, poo-pooed it off. You know, Jamie's 14 years old, and, you know, teenagers are teenagers, and I kind of blew it off. So as August progressed, I noticed at this time that odd things started happening in my house. And, you know, once again, I wasn't putting much into, you know, this whole visit that we had taken to the cemetery because, you know, I go logical all the way first. I don't go to paranormal first. I'm making excuses, you know, like a book flew down the staircase one time, and my husband started experiencing hearing things, and you know, I just kind of blew it off. So we get into September. Jamie starts school, and about a week after school starts, I get a phone call from the school, and the school says that Jamie is not going to be able to ride the bus for the rest of the school year. And I was mortified. I had worked for this school, I knew everybody, and I was absolutely mortified. And I was like, you know, what's going on? And they were like, you know, he just kind of riles everybody up on that bus, and the bus drivers just about had it. So I said, you know, please don't kick him off the school bus for the rest of the year. Let me talk to him. And, you know, he came home from school, and I read him the Riot Act, and I said, you know, this doesn't go on. Mm-hmm. So I noticed that as time went on, that his personality changed, and I was taking note of it. I really didn't put a lot into it, just to the fact of this is a teenage boy. So I really gotta, you know, tighten up the belt with this kid and make sure that, you know, this isn't just, you know, a teenage boy being a teenage boy. And really, really started, you know, writing him about, you know, the way he acts.
Sure.
So it comes to October, and I lecture at colleges for a living. And I had a very big year this year, and I was going to be leaving my house at almost the beginning of the second week in August, and I was going to be gone until the first week of November, and that's basically being on the road at lecturing at colleges. And at the same time, I'm also going to school full-time at a university about 40 miles away. So when I was home, I was in school, and if I, you know, very, very rarely was I home. My husband, who works nights, and he's home till probably about 8:30 at night. So I was pretty confident with Jamie being 14 that he could be on his own, you know, putting himself to bed and getting himself up. And, you know, my husband gets home at like 5 in the morning to get him up for school. And so I hit the road, and I came back at Columbus Day weekend, and I was home for Jamie's half day for that school day. So Jamie gets off the bus, and I hadn't seen him for a couple days, and, you know, he comes in the house, and the phone starts ringing, and immediately it's his teachers. And every teacher called up that day except one at this point, and they were explaining that his grades have gone down, and that his behavior was just so questionable, and every single teacher was saying the same thing. And I'm sitting there going, okay, you know, what is going on with this kid? You know, if this kid needs discipline, I'm all about discipline. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm getting angrier by each phone call. And by 4 o'clock, I said to my husband, I said, well, we heard from every teacher except one. And literally at that point, the phone rang, and it was the very last teacher, and this was Jamie's favorite teacher. And she was crying, and I said, what's going on? And she explained that she was leaving the school district, and she said, I saved this phone call for last. And I said, well, you know, why are you leaving? You know, she'd been with the school district for years and years and years. And I said, you know, why are you leaving? And she said, I'm leaving because of your son. And it was like somebody punched me in the stomach, and I went, what? And she went on to explain that Jamie was always the last one in the room because he had to come from other side of the building. And she said that the class would be fine, and Jamie would come in right after the second bell would ring. And she said when he would walk in that classroom, she said he would come in, and she said the students just got riled up. And it wasn't like, she said Jamie didn't do anything to rile them up. She said it was just like he would walk in the room and the room would just kind of explode. And I'm sitting there trying to figure out what she's saying to me. And she said, Stacy, she goes, I've had Jamie for 2 years now. And she goes, I hate your son. And I was dumbfounded.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm taking offense to this, and I'm like, you know, what are you saying? She goes, I don't know what I'm saying, but I just can't be here anymore. And she hung up the phone. So I go upstairs and I sit down with Jamie, and the only way I could describe him at this point, you know, it led up to this point. It wasn't something that was overnight, but he it really wasn't him. And I go up to his room and I, you know, read him the riot act. I'm like, you know, you're failing all your classes, and, you know, you're getting kicked off the school bus. You know, what kind of BS is going on here? I said, you know, this is telling me that I can't trust you, that you know, and I read him the riot act, and I was like, you need to just get your shit together. Excuse my French.
You're fine.
You just need to get yourself together here. So I slammed the door, and, you know, I put all sorts of everything on this kid. I was like, you're not going anywhere. You are going to be within my sight. You're going to buckle down, and this is the way it's going to be. So unfortunately, I had to go back on the road. So I was gone for another couple days, and came home, and I had a big show in Syracuse, and that was a long day. You know, I was on the road and then had to do this show, and I come back at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and as I pull up into the street, I look, and every light is on in my house, and I thought, uh-oh, this has always been an indication from Jamie that something's wrong. So I get out of the car, I walk in the house, and every light is on, and I go into his room, and I said, what's going on in here? And he sat up in bed, he looked at me, sound asleep, he just woke up from his sleep, sat up in bed, looked at me, and said, well, why don't you go call Lloyd? I said, I'm not calling Lloyd, I'm asking you. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, whatever I tell you is never going to be good enough for you, go call Lloyd. So I go downstairs, call my husband at work, and I'm like, what went on here tonight? And he went on to explain that he had let him go hang out with a friend, and they were skateboarding, and he fell through a plate glass window at a storefront in town. And I'm losing my mind. I'm like, oh my gosh, what is going on? So I go back upstairs, and I wake him up again, and I said, what happened? And he's like, I got pushed through the window. I said, who pushed you through the window? He goes, never mind, it doesn't matter. And he just wouldn't talk. So the next morning, the phone rings, and it's the owner of the store, and she was checking on Jamie, and I said, what happened? She goes, I can't tell you. She said, he was walking. He wasn't on a skateboard. He was walking, and all of a sudden, it looked like he was pushed through this window. And she said, I don't understand how he lived, because there was a 6-foot shard of glass that literally went up through his armpit, and it should have impaled him. I don't understand how it, you know, this whole thing.
Yeah.
So, of course, I had to make arrangements, you know, $1,000 to pay for this plate glass window, and Jamie comes home from school, and I'm like, you know, we need to talk. And he's completely shutting me out, and I'm thinking, okay, this is just the worst teenage years I've ever had. You know, I'm at wit's end with this kid. He's not talking to me, and so at this point, I'm really wondering if he needs to be put somewhere for his safety, because, you know, he's kind of demonstrating that he can't be alone.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, I was almost done with my tour. It was towards the end of December. I was only going to be gone for a few more days. And I said to Jamie, I said, you know, I'll be back in a couple days. Just hold it together. You know, do what you got to do. You know, let's get through this together. So I go back on the road, and I finally get back, and, you know, everything's kind of quiet, and I immediately get back into full-time school, and I'm trying to make up my classwork and everything else. And it's about a week later. This is probably the first week in November. I get a panic phone call from him in the middle of a test in school that there is something going on, and he's absolutely hysterical. And I said, Jamie, what's going on? And in the background, I hear what sounds like somebody beating on walls. But it wasn't like he was doing it, because it sounded far away.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what is that? And he said, it's coming from the laundry room. So I said, Jamie, go in the laundry room, you know, and he goes to the laundry room, and you can actually hear through the phone that it's now towards another part of the house. So wherever he would go, it would go opposite if he was. So I said, Jamie, hang up the phone. I'm calling the neighbor across the street. So I hung up the phone. I called my neighbor and I said, do me a favor. I don't know what is going on over there. Can you get over there? He said, yeah, no problem. So at this point, it had been snowing. So my neighbor goes over, knocks on the door. Jamie lets him in. Jamie's absolutely hysterical. And the neighbor could hear this knocking through the house. And the neighbor goes outside thinking somebody playing tricks, and he goes around the house and, you know, fresh snow, there's no footprints, there's no nothing, and he could still hear it going on inside. So he grabbed Jamie and took him across the street, and I headed home. So I finally sat down with Jamie and I said, you've got to tell me what's going on. And he starts to explain that these things are happening to him, that you know, the knocking, this was the first time he heard the knocking, but he also heard what sounds like smacking of lips in his ear, and, you know, all these different things. And he went on to explain that he was in his room once and the tape dispenser flew across the room and put a hole in the wall, and, you know, all these things. So me, I'm still trying to think that this is just his bad behavior, that he's just acting out.
Sure.
So at this point, I'm very good friends with John Zappas, and I since August, I've been talking to John and filling John in on everything that's going on. And John's telling me, hey, look, you know, something's going on. This kid has got something going on. And me, I'm trying to say, you know, oh, it's teenage years, or he's a poltergeist kid, or, you know, me, I'm trying to come up with a logical explanation. And, you know, John's still on the road at this point because he lectures at colleges and he's not going to get back for quite a while. And, you know, John's like, okay, I let me see if there's somebody that can help us. So now we're into Thanksgiving, and Jamie's off from school, and I'm off from school. You know, I got my break from college, and I go into his room, and I find that my diamond earrings are in his room. I find his report cards. I find all this, you know, I find things that he's taken from people, and I'm ready to absolutely just, this kid's going to move out. He's going to go live with his real father. I've had it with this kid. I don't put up with thieves, you know, all of this. Mm-hmm. And I really sincerely was ready to just beat the snot out of this kid. So I'm trying to calm myself down. My husband's trying to keep me calm. And Jamie, you know, Jamie's in between my husband and I, and I'm screaming at him, and I'm screaming and yelling and everything else. And at this point, a cigarette lighter that was in the kitchen flies across the room and lands in front of my feet, and all three of us saw it. And Jamie looks at me with this look of, like, satisfaction. So I send him up to his room, and at this point, I'm convinced he's a poltergeist kid, that, you know, that poltergeists are, you know, telekinetic, you know, energy from teenagers. And, you know, I don't know if I really believe that, but, you know, I'm trying to explain this away.
Sure.
And I send Jamie up to his room, and this is the way that all of basically November and December goes down. He would come home from school, and he'd walk in the door, and the only way I could describe the progression was, like, every time he would come home, it was like he was trying to get into my head. And I got no other way to explain it. It just felt like it wasn't him. And I was a single mom for a long time before I met my present husband. And that mother bond, it's like you kind of feel it and you know it. And it just didn't feel like him. So I'm still talking to Zappas. Zappas is trying to make arrangements for Jamie. And I'm still not 100% buying the fact that, you know, that this is a paranormal thing. So we're just about right. We're right near Christmas at this point, and we decide we're going to go Christmas shopping. And we head to a box store, and we're walking in the store. And again, Jamie is constantly trying to get into my head. I can't explain it. It's just I couldn't even really stand to be even near him because it was this constant thing with him. So we're in the store, and I said to Jamie, I said, do me a favor. I said, dude, just go take a walk. Just take a walk from us. So he disappears, and my husband and I are walking, and we're talking, and all of a sudden, I could feel him, and I couldn't see him. I'm kind of looking around, and I'm walking, and I'm like, you know, he's that buzzing, that constant vying to try to get into my head. And I turned to my husband and I said, do me a favor. I said, turn around and look. I said, is Jamie behind us? And he looked and he goes, yep, he's about 15 feet behind us. So, you know, we get through Christmas and, you know, at this point, you know, we're working through Christmas and John finally says, okay, I really think he needs an exorcism. Now, at this point, I'm really thinking that an exorcism will be a great idea for him, just maybe for the placebo effect of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was not a big proponent on any kind of possessions or anything like that. I wasn't raised Catholic. I've studied it. I understand it. I've been in exorcisms before, and I really truly believe that it's a good thing for psychological reasons and also for the placebo effect, that if anything helps, then you know what? Anything's good.
Sure.
So I agreed to it, and I said to John, I said, okay, we'll be down, you know, on this date in January. And at this point, I really, really thought, okay, I started putting everything together, and I really was like, something's not right here. It was just everything that was going on with him and how I felt and everything. I just knew that something, you know, right in the core wasn't right. And Jamie had been in counseling, mind you, now for about 2 years before this. And I had talked to his counselor back in, you know, September when he started acting out in school. And I asked the counselor to see if she could figure out what was going on. So, you know, I understood that, you know, this kid needed counseling, and, you know, I continued with the counseling. So I wasn't 100% relying on religion. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm looking at everything at this point. So I really didn't want him to know what deep down I knew, because I really thought it would be worse for him and worse for my husband if they knew, if the cat was out of the bag. That's kind of what the feeling I got from it. And I really felt that whatever activity in the house and what was going on with my kid and my husband, you know, my husband was experiencing things too, when he was a total non-believer in this. And, you know, I started hearing the knockings on the wall. We started hearing what sounded like the house being ripped apart, and nothing was wrong. I mean, all these things were starting to happen in the house. And I wasn't acknowledging, because my gut was telling me that if I really vocalized that this was something paranormal, that it, whatever it was going to ramp up. And I just thought that ignorance is bliss at this point, that I just got to make it till we got to get this exorcism. So the day of the exorcism, Jamie was in school, and, you know, I woke him up like I did the normal time, and he gets up, and I said, go take a shower, and, you know, I told him what to wear and meet me downstairs. So he did, and he came down the stairs, and he's, you know, getting breakfast, and I said, you're not going to school today, and he said, okay, and, you know, kind of happy, 14 years old, doesn't have to go to school.
Sure.
And I said, we're taking a trip. And we jumped in the car and we started driving. And he really didn't ask where we were going till maybe 2 hours into the trip. And finally turned to me and just kind of said, are we going to where I think we're going? And I said, well, where do you think we're going? And he said, we're going to Connecticut, aren't we? And I said, yes. And he said, good luck with that. So, kept the trip up. We get to John's house. We turn around and we go to Father Larry's house. And even walking up the stairs to get this exorcism, I still was a little bit in my mind thinking this was going to be a placebo effect,
mm-hmm.
that this was going to be good for him, that, you know, whatever. So we get in there, and of course, you know, John likes to kid around, and, you know, we were all laughing and everything else, and Jamie's kind of sitting there just kind of looking around, not really understanding what the hell's going on, until Father Larry came out in his priest garb and got this really panicked look on his face, and I was instructed to sit and not to interfere in any way. And you have to understand, Jamie, at the age of 14, was already 6 foot tall and 200 pounds. He's a big kid. And when the father started doing this exorcism, the look on this kid's face told me that he was going to hurt this guy. And this was not a look I ever saw before. And I sat through this exorcism, and it was fascinating to watch your son, your child, the child that you watched him grow up, have these looks on his face that you just never saw before. And it was looks of like, I'm really now really concerned about Larry and Larry getting hurt.
Yeah. That wraps up part one of our interview with Stacy Jones. Join us for part two when you become a gravekeeper through patreon.com/thegravetalks or through our website, thegravetalks.com. In part two of our interview, we'll find out what was the result of the exorcism on Stacy's son. What dark experiences had Stacy's son been going through while this dark entity was attached to him? What were the messages it was whispering in his ear? Was this a true possession or an attachment? Also, prior to the exorcism, did Stacy's son suspect that something dark was attached to him? And looking back, was there anything different about the investigation where that dark spirit became a part of Stacy's son's life? To listen to part two of our interview, you need to be a gravekeeper through our website, thegravetalks.com, or directly through patreon.com/thegravetalks. You'll have access to part two of this interview and all of our interviews, as well as advanced access to our show months before the episodes go public. If you're ready to binge away on many more episodes of this show not available to the public yet, then become a gravekeeper. patreon.com/thegravetalks and help keep us on the air. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.